Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon, welcome along, and thank you for choosing Premier Christian Radio and Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Whether you're listening via the radio set this Saturday or whether you're listening somewhere around the world at a different time in the week via the podcast, it's great to have you on board the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter. I'll be introducing my guest for this week's show, which is the second part, really, of a conversation that began a couple of months ago. If you want to find out more about Unbelievable, check out the past programmes, join the many people who do download the show every week, plus find more interviews, features, videos, and of course links to the Unbelievable book, then do go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Excited to say that the Unbelievable conference on DVD and MP3 CD has been arriving with happy punters all over the place, and you can join them as well. We had a wonderful day in London back in May when we heard from some brilliant Christian thinkers, including John Lennox, Andy Bannister, Beth Grove, Jeremiah J. Johnston. I'm on the DVD as well. If you want to order it for yourself, do go to the Premier shop and they'll send it out to you, or get the digital download. premier.org.uk/shop. Straight after Unbelievable this afternoon, you can hear The Profile. Katie Stock is speaking to eminent US theologian Stanley Hauerwas. That'll be an unmissable one if you're a bit of a theology geek. And don't forget that you can catch up with The Profile via the podcast as well. It's got its own podcast if you search it out on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. Right now, though, it's time to get into today's show. You're unbelievable. Well, I'm getting grilled again on the programme this week. Mike Rand, former police officer and agnostic show listener, who I think would describe himself as sort of on a hunt for faith, at least, rather like his detective work of old. He's returning today to undertake a second round of interrogating me on my book, Unbelievable, Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Today, we're going to be looking at the second half of the book. We kind of managed to cover the first half last time, covering things like the resurrection this time, evil and suffering, Dawkins and the New Atheism, living in the Christian story of reality. That's the chapter title for the final chapter. And just why atheists have been tuning into Unbelievable over the last 10 years. And of course, curious agnostics like Mike, who is a lovely bloke, let me reiterate. Not really an interrogation. It's more a friendly chat down the pub, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah, well, I would hope so. Definitely. Definitely.
It's always lovely to have you come up. You've got a lovely sunny disposition.
Oh, thank you very much.
Which probably is related to where you come from in the world, down on the south coast in Dorset.
Yeah, it's a lovely part of the world. It's a great place.
Hasn't been the most sunny of summers as yet, but we hope it can always get better.
Yes.
So, Mike, thank you for coming back in. And again, it's that weird scenario where I am not the interviewer, you are, and you're going to be sort of quizzing me on
yes.
the book.
Yeah. Okay, Justin. Well, thank you very much. Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to come up again.
So. It's great to have you back, yeah. I mean, you very kindly did read the book before it was published and were kind enough to endorse it as a sort of non-believing show listener. But just for the sake of the listeners who maybe don't remember, you've kind of been on a little bit of a journey looking for faith ever since you walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and had what you could only describe as a sort of spiritual experience.
Yeah, I mean, it became quite obvious to me some 18 years ago that I developed this drink problem and was in a bit of trouble with it, and got introduced via a very close friend of mine to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to say, from the very minute I walked into that room, my life changed, and something happened to me that day, and I've been trying to rationalize it ever since, really,
and sort of recapture it.
In a way, I do.
But you've never quite managed.
Well, I think I do recapture it almost on a daily basis, okay. To a lesser degree. But I think what I've tried to do is try to find a similar type of feeling within the Christian church, and that somehow the Christian church just don't get it.
Hasn't quite connected.
No, it hasn't connected in the same way that did. Yeah.
You've nevertheless had some very kind words about the book, and obviously you've been a keen show listener for some time.
Yes,
and we're going to continue to to look at your response and the questions that came out of reading the book as well. Before we get into that, I should just let those listening know that if you want more info on the book, there's a free downloadable first chapter as well. And also now options to purchase a signed copy exclusively via our website at unbelievablebook.co.uk. That's the place to go for more info on the book. And excitingly, an audiobook also being made available. So so watch this space. But we're going to get into the conversation now as I get grilled by Mike Rand, again, former police officer and agnostic show listener. Do stay tuned here on Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And of course, if you've got questions about today's show, anything you'd like to comment on, send your feedback in to me. The email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can, of course, get in touch via social media as well, at UnbelievableJB to follow on Twitter. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is the Facebook page of the show. Look forward to receiving your thoughts and feedback there. And, of course, you can comment underneath today's programme at the webpage itself, where you can find links to the podcast, further resources and much more besides. And, of course, we'll make sure there's a link to the first of these two programmes that we recorded with Mike as well there. Today's show available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. That's my little announcements out the way, Mike, so take it away. You're the interviewer now.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Justin. I think probably the easiest way is just to have a few brief questions about the basis of the programme before we even start. I mean, to my view, you have got great skill and fairness the way you manage conversations between your guests. I mean, I think it's the reason that the programme succeeds is because you come across with a very, very balanced and
that's very kind,
great ability to. And sometimes there's some very deep philosophical questions and
too
and
deep
conversations.
For me sometimes.
Well, you've got a way of sorting the wheat from the chaff, I must admit.
It's called blagging it.
Is it?
That's what
well,
it is.
You've certainly got a way of cutting to the chase, and I think it's great. I know you get messages from all over the world, especially from the USA, and I think they wish that they had a similar open and honest format type program. So
well, that's interesting, because it is one of the most frequent messages I do get from listeners in the USA is we don't have anything like this.
Yes,
in the USA you obviously do get sort of talk shows that are driven by a bit of a conflict model, but I think they tend to be very much sound bites. It's, you know, this person speaks for 2 minutes, then the other person, and then they move on. Whereas I think giving the space of that Unbelievable gives, it means that you tend to have a much more substantive kind of interaction.
Have you found over the years that it varies from country to country in the type of response that you get? Or is it,
yeah,
do you get similar things from all over the world?
Well, inevitably, the show, you know, as a podcast, the largest audience actually is in the USA and Canada. So,
right.
So that's significant in as much as, obviously, there's a lot of Christians out there, and a lot of non-Christians as well. I think the population dynamics mean that there's more people out there who are looking for this kind of material, downloading these kinds of podcasts. And so inevitably, a lot of the feedback I've had to the show has been from the North American, Canadian kind of context.
Yes.
And certainly, it's very noticeable that the kinds of issues that are exercising both skeptics and Christians in America are a bit different to here in the UK.
Okay.
There's much more of a sense of a conflict between the church and the culture, I think, to some extent, in the USA than there is here. You do get that here,
right.
But it's not as much on the general agenda as you tend to find, I think, in the US, where I think there's just been a lot more of a sense that of Christians feeling that their freedoms to exercise their beliefs are being curtailed in some ways because of movements in the culture and so on, and equally atheists who are very angry about the influence that the church has had, despite the, you know, separation that exists,
yes,
between church and state,
yeah,
in the USA. I tend to find that the skeptics are more vociferous on average from,
right,
the USA, because I think they're a bit more reacting to what they see as an oppressive or dogmatic kind of culture that maybe, you know, they don't feel as treated non-believers fairly.
Okay.
Whereas in the UK, because there just simply hasn't been that, the church for a long time really hasn't had the critical mass to really sort of tell anyone what to do or believe for a long time in the UK. I think there just isn't that kind of dynamic going on. People don't feel like the church is invading my rights or beliefs or,
no,
or anything like that.
No.
You know, people can be perfectly happily live a secular life in the UK without sort of feeling like the church is,
yes,
is in any way invading on their secular space, if you,
yeah,
like.
Okay, well, it's interesting to see the difference between the countries, you know.
Yeah, I think that's the difference, though. Definitely there's just there's the culture wars in America.
Yeah, yeah.
Just very different to the UK. And yeah. So we do cover that material, obviously, on the show. But very often if we're doing it in the UK context, it's not quite the same as the US.
One of the things that's always interested me, really, is that obviously you're a Christian radio station.
Mm.
But you've got a big following amongst atheists and agnostics like myself. Why do you think it attracts atheists specifically more than agnostics? Because as an agnostic, I'm not sure. I mean, yeah. I think there may well be a God, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think there are probably more of you listening than you probably realise, actually, yeah. Mike. I think there are probably more agnostics, people who just haven't quite decided or make up their mind or whatever, than you might think. I think the thing is that you tend to hear more from the more kind of decided person who's decided, no, there definitely isn't a God, because they're the people who tend to be publishing on these issues, you know, setting up websites. You don't get that many websites of agnostics saying, I just haven't made my mind up yet.
No.
But you do get plenty of websites of atheists saying, I have made my mind up and here's why, and why I think religion is bad for us and everything else. So inevitably, that tends to be the natural place you go to for the contributors.
Yes.
It's easier, in a sense, to find atheists, you know, who are have planted their flag in the ground there to contribute than agnostics like yourself, because they don't tend to advertise themselves quite as much.
But I just wonder why an atheist would even want to, if you're absolutely adamant there isn't a God,
why would you bother?
Why would you bother even listening
into a show
or arguing?
It's a really good question. And what I would first of all say is, obviously, the vast majority of people who listen to the show on air as a radio show that goes out on Saturdays, obviously they're Christians, because it's a Christian radio station, it's primarily drawing a Christian audience.
Yeah.
What brought in lots of atheists and agnostics and skeptics and people of other faiths was obviously the podcast. And because of the accessibility of that, the way it was, obviously, you know, you can listen to it anytime, you don't have to be, you know, buy your radio set on a Saturday afternoon, that opened it up to a whole new segment of listeners. And what was surprising was how many of them turned out to be non-believers who started tuning in. I tell you, I think one of the key things that has made that happen, that has kind of seen the show grow and grow in that sense among a non-believing audience, which I'm really grateful for, is when we've had high-profile skeptics on, who have then maybe posted it to their website, blog, social media, and suddenly you notice a whole new raft of people coming on board as listeners.
Yeah, they've picked it up via other
streams.
And
have maybe been pleasantly surprised that, hey, actually, I wasn't expecting this, but actually these discussions are quite interesting
and so
on, and they've made me think a bit. And why would they, you know, tune in, keep listening? Well, I think partly it is that there is, you know, still a big conversation going on in culture about God, about faith, about whether we need religion or whether religion's bad for us. And because of that, I think even if you've made your mind up that there's no God, you'll still want to hear why other people are claiming there is one and why it's important for our culture and that kind of thing. And because that conversation is still buzzing away and going on in all kinds of ways in culture, I think that's why even, you know, the average atheist is still interested in tuning in. I also think, you know, when I meet a lot of atheists, they're not saying I'm closed to the whole idea now. You know, a good atheist, you know, is usually open to the evidence and being persuaded.
Yeah. Richard Dawkins will say, I'm not saying there isn't a God.
Yeah.
I just haven't. Nobody's ever shown me enough evidence.
So you know, he's saying he's a 6.5 on the 1 to 7 scale or whatever that he invented, but you know, there's still a 0.5 there where there's obviously an element of, you know, well, I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And so I think that's important. I think and I think at the end of the day, you know, one interesting aspect of the type of atheist who I often hear from is actually an ex-Christian atheist.
Right.
So someone maybe
who's
lost their faith. So that might be someone maybe who grew up in the Bible Belt in America, for instance. But when they got to college, university or whatever, they suddenly stuff was presented to them which didn't fit with what they'd been told in church. Suddenly it provoked some kind of crisis of faith, and maybe they ended up losing their faith altogether. But what I often find in those cases is there's still a kind of they're still living in a kind of Christian world. You know, maybe their family members are Christians. Maybe, you know, that's where all their history is. There's still a lot of attachment and residue from that. And I think a lot of people are still sorting out the issues, even if they've maybe made a decision, oh, I don't think I believe in God anymore.
Right.
There's still a kind of, I need to work this through, process that. And I think a lot of, my feeling is that a lot of ex-Christian atheists who listen to the show are kind of doing that. Unbelievable is a way of sort of them processing this and kind of doing a bit of a stock take of, okay, why, what, you know, putting it all together and sometimes reassessing whether they did have good reason to ditch their faith.
Yeah.
I certainly get emails from people who they may not have, you know, crossed the line to Christian faith again, but they might sort of say, well, I've gone from hard-boiled atheist to curious agnostic now, you know.
Yeah, there's different levels.
There are. And for me, obviously, I unashamedly hope that people will be attracted to the Christian worldview. I'm a Christian. I'm an evangelist at heart. The show, I'm not expecting the show to always have that effect on anyone. Of course I'm not. But even when someone just makes a little move along the journey to where they're maybe a little bit more open-minded to the claims of Christianity, for me, that's something I'm hugely encouraged by, actually.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Okay. Just out of interest, very quickly, I mean, is there a favourite show of yours? Is there one?
Ooh,
apart from the one with Mike Rand and David Robertson.
It's like asking me to choose between my children.
I wouldn't ask that.
I mean, genuinely, I really did enjoy that first show David Robertson.
He was very kind. He was very kind.
You're both quite similar in the sense that you're both lively, engaging characters who just love to have a good conversation and very often, you know, and that was kind of, we moved at about a million miles an hour, I felt like, in that conversation, because it was always like
bringing up
a new subject every 2 minutes
and I suddenly thought
that,
something
that's
else
the way conversations often happen. It's not always terribly, you know, structured, and I think that was a really good example of two people just enjoying having a conversation. So that's a show that was quite memorable to me for that reason. But yeah, I mean, it just depends. I mean, there's certainly memorable shows which maybe are memorable for the wrong reasons.
Okay.
You know, where you could have cut the air with a knife because it was so hostile or tense in the studio when we were
so
recording.
So do you find yourself having to intervene at that time to somehow...
Yeah, it's one where I can sometimes feel quite uncomfortable myself. And I've sort of... And I'm still thinking, am I here to provoke this drama, this conflict? Or am I here to try and pour oil on troubled waters? Yeah. Because this is kind of getting a little bit... you know, I mean, one good example, actually, a couple of years ago, it got a load of downloads, but it was a debate on homosexuality between Jane Ozan, who is has become in recent years here in the UK a well-known advocate of a progressive kind of LGBT inclusive view, and Robert Gagnon, who out in the USA is well known as sort of being on the very opposite end of that, very critical of the LGBT movement. And having them both in studio, in a rather small one, like the one we're recording in today, actually, Mike, that it quickly got very tense because it wasn't just the issues that
were they both in
debated.
The studio?
They were both in the studio with me. So sometimes when someone's on a phone line, it's not so bad. But when they're both in the studio with you, and frankly, both were kind of questioning the other person's character as much as their arguments, and that's when it starts to get tense because they're you know, to use that rugby phrase, they're playing the man and not the ball, or whatever, you know. And it's at that point when people start to get, you know, sort of launch attacks on individuals rather than their arguments, that it starts to cross that line into being quite uncomfortable. I'm kind of casting my mind back to it, and what I think that sort of when we took the breaks for the show, I would just sort of try to just calm things down a bit and smooth things out a bit. But it does very much depend on the personalities, and those were two personalities where it was the combustible mix creates that kind of a show. Yeah. So that was memorable, but again, perhaps for the wrong reasons. But
mind you, if that's probably the worst in 10 years,
there are some other examples I could mention, but I won't. But certainly though, when you have a really fantastic, like, it just feels like it's firing on all cylinders, you're getting good engagement from both sides, you feel like you really learnt a lot in the course of the discussion.
Yeah.
Those are also very memorable and you know, thoroughly enjoyable as well. And there's been obviously plenty of those as well.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Well, shall I move it on to look at the book and We were going to start on chapter 6, I know, because that's about the halfway stage where we reached last time.
Yes.
And your chapter 6 is in relation to facts that only fit the resurrection. It's about the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
I had to include it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite an important issue. I've got to say, in all honesty, it's always been a bit of a mystery to me, and I've got some grave doubts about... Well, grave doubts is probably the wrong phrase. I apologise for that.
No, that was a great pun, actually.
No, it wasn't meant to be.
I should have titled the chapter Grave Doubts.
Yes.
That would have been very good.
Yeah, I didn't mean that. It sounded like a Preston pantomime group special, that one. But you've had a number of guests on the show who have actually come to faith purely on the basis of researching the resurrection. I can remember shows where people, yeah, that's the reason they believe.
There are people definitely for whom it's been an important factor. I never think there's ever one single argument usually that brings people to faith. There are usually significant elements that had to fall into place for them. But certainly there are people like Lee Strobel, who, you know, has his story of having been a sort of atheist/agnostic journalist and sort of went on a quest to disprove his wife's faith wrong when she became a Christian and came to believe that Jesus really did exist and really did rise from the dead.
It is
a critical thing for many people. I must say, though, when I became a Christian, it wasn't on the basis of any particular intellectual argument, and certainly not an argument about the resurrection. I did believe Jesus was raised from the dead, but I guess I always assumed that was something you sort of believed on quote-unquote faith. Though I would now maybe define faith a little differently to the way I did back then. I was converted, as we said last time, on the basis of an experience I had.
Yes.
And the resurrection sort of made sense of that experience. But it was only later that I came to realise, oh, and there are also some quite good historical data that seem to support this idea that Jesus was actually raised from the dead. And for people like you and others who haven't had my experience, I think they're a good starting place to say, have you considered where this evidence leads and what it might be telling us?
Yeah. I suppose.
But you're not convinced, obviously.
I know there have been many shows and we've gone into great depth.
Yeah,
so I mean, I don't really want to go into great depth. I fully accept that there are great differences within the Gospels.
Mm.
And I think that's a bit of a stumbling block for
problem?
A lot of people.
Yeah.
Not, it's probably yeah. not the only problem. Yeah. But I almost accept that there's going to be different tellings.
That's why in the chapter the way I approach it is very much this what's called this minimal fact approach.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people do stumble over the fact that you've obviously got differences in the resurrection narratives between the Gospels.
Yeah.
You know, different, apparently at least different numbers of people involved, women, were there angels at the tomb, weren't there, you know. And I think what's helpful with the minimal facts, just to briefly explain that for those who aren't familiar, it's just simply asking, what do the majority of scholars in this area, believing or non-believing, affirm are, you know, reliable facts about what happened, without having to have any pre-commitment to the authority or inerrancy of Scripture or anything like that.
Hmm.
Just simply, you know, as historians, what can they say? We're very confident in these particular facts about.
Hmm.
And I list, you know, a set of about five of them, which include the fact that Jesus died by crucifixion. Again, that is a hugely well-attested fact across the scholarship, you know. His empty tomb was discovered by a group of women followers.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you make a big point about that,
yeah.
about the finding, because women's testimony in those days was of lesser value than men's.
Indeed, yeah.
But, I mean, is that a really compelling reason? I mean, to me, if I've got my cynical head on, it could be that the disciples already fled in fear.
Mm-hmm.
There had to be an explanation as to why anybody would return to the tomb anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So women going with oils would be an explanation, if you like, a literary explanation as to why somebody would find an empty tomb.
Yeah.
Could it be that this is just a myth that's built up over time?
It could be. I mean, that's always an option on the table.
Yeah.
But I think you have to ask in the historical context, does it make sense? And if you put that explanation for why the gospel writers would have had women as the first discoverers of the empty tomb, does it feel like that makes sense? And for me, what my own research on this seems to show that it would have been highly unlikely for anyone seeking to persuade someone else of the truth of this story, which is actually a bit of a fabrication or a mythology. It would have been very odd for them to make women the first discoverers, as you say, because of this fact of the way that women's testimony was regarded in that day and age. It's if you were going to choose between the male followers or the female followers, it would be it's odd, strange, bizarre to put women ahead of the men, and yet there they are. And as I explained in the book, and others before me have said much better as well, this is what's known as one of these sort of historical criteria of embarrassment, something that was sort of embarrassing at the time. If you find it in the documents, you can have a lot more reliability that that's true then, because people don't tend to make up embarrassing things about themselves. They normally airbrush those out, if you like. And for me, that is a telltale sign in that sense of the authenticity of these accounts. And of course, the fact that in all four accounts, this is a common theme throughout them. Yes, there are differences in various details, but one of the key themes throughout is that women were the first discoverers of the empty tomb.
But Mark's gospel, to my understanding, leaves it there, really.
It does.
They get some ghostly figure who explains there's been a resurrection.
And it's kind of a strange ending as
it's
well.
It's a very bizarre
ending.
It's just
ending. The women sort of fled and didn't tell anyone.
But if you take the other gospels are written after Mark, Mark is the earliest, and there's no mention of the risen Christ appearing there. Well, to some extent, that does that lessen.
Well, there's this kind of question mark over Mark, because obviously the women are told that Christ is risen, though we don't get the story of them bumping into a risen Christ sort of soon after, as we do in the other gospels, or Christ appearing to the disciples later. Now, there's a lot of interesting stuff over the ending of Mark, and this wasn't something I had time to get into really in the book, but there's this kind of additional ending to Mark, which in most Bibles is clearly marked as this only appears in later manuscripts. And
yes.
it appears that
there's
this was something
ending
that was kind of added later to kind of wrap the story up.
Yes.
Because to a lot of people, it looks like the way that Mark does end in the early manuscripts, it looks like something's missing, like it ended too early, like the end got lost somehow.
Yes.
And I've just got a hunch, maybe maybe the earliest editions of Mark, you did have something else happening afterwards, maybe, you know, in line with what you do find picked up in Matthew and Luke.
But even the additional little part doesn't really give any more detail.
Yeah, but that's speculation on my part.
I'm
kind of trying to fill in the gap there.
Yeah.
The fact is, you know, treating the Gospels as historical documents, you've just got what you've got to work with, and you could wish that we had a bit more of a satisfactory explanation for why Mark ends in that funny way.
Yeah.
But on the basis of, you know, and I'm following the accepted scholarship, I suppose, here, the fact is that it is seen as a pretty strong historical fact that women followers discovered this empty tomb.
Yeah.
But even if you sort of drop that one off,
yes,
you know, and you know, Gary Habermas, when he came on to discuss this, said, look, if you're not happy about that particular minimal fact, I'm going to give you that. I'm going to, you know, say, okay, don't accept that one. The other ones still are perfectly adequate to establish the case for the resurrection. And I think that's interesting, because this isn't a case that's dependent on one particular piece of evidence. It's kind of that cumulative case.
The second one is in relation to the people reporting meeting the risen Christ.
Yeah.
But they're so very different, aren't they? This is I've struggled with this for a long time.
Mm.
I mean, there are women who thought it was a gardener. Disciples met a strange man on the road to
Emmaus.
Yeah. And the indication that people didn't recognise him. We talked about that when I first came in.
Why don't we
identification issue?
You did actually, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the lineup, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Was it really here?
Well, look, we need to get to a break right now. So why don't we pick that question up on the other side of a quick break?
Okay.
The interviewer has turned interviewee today. It's round two of my conversation with Mike Rand. Mike is a former police officer and agnostic show listener, but certainly on his own journey and hunt for faith. He's returned kindly today for a second round of interrogating me on my book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. You want to find out more about it? It's available now, unbelievablebook.co.uk. And I'll be back with more with me and Mike in conversation in just a moment's time. We're celebrating Wonder Women in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, as the United Reformed Church marks 100 years of female ordination this month. What can Jeremy Corbyn's youth revolution teach us about engaging young people in the church? 50 years on from 1967's Summer of Love, we'll examine what the Jesus People hippie revolution did for the church. Plus, top US theologian Stanley Hauerwas on war, peace and Donald Trump. All that plus much more. Ask for a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. And on Unbelievable today, the tables again being turned on me, because a couple of months ago I was joined by show listener Mike Rand, who's an agnostic, a former police officer, and he interrogated me on my new book, which makes the case for faith through many of the conversations I've had here on the Unbelievable show. The book's available now, by the way. Why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. That's at unbelievablebook.co.uk. But we had so much fun having our conversation on the last time we did this. We only got about halfway through the book, so I said, hey, Mike, why don't you come back and we'll do a round two, and that's what we're doing today. So thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Into studio. Just another reminder, if you would like to send in your thoughts and feedback, you can do that to our email address, as usual, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Tweet us at UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook. All of those links and other ways to get in touch from the webpage as well of this show, where you can find today's programme and even leave a comment there too. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. Lots of links to further resources, videos, articles and more besides as well. And don't forget that straight after today's programme you can hear The Profile, where another Christian from some walk of faith and life will be talking to us about their journey. But this is the programme where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk. And Mike Rand is one of the loveliest non-Christians I've ever met, actually. And I just feel like when we get together to talk, the time flies. You remarked how quickly that last section went, Mike. Yeah. It's like we're down the pub just having a natter. And that's great. So let's finish up our conversation on the resurrection, and we'll move on to another chapter or two.
Okay. I mean, the identification issue, I say that tongue-in-cheek from a previous life, I've been a police officer. But if somebody doesn't recognise somebody when they meet them, you think, well,
what's going on?
Was it really Jesus?
Mm, yeah.
That's one of the first. And David Robertson, when I met him that time, suggested that, well, if you're not expecting to see somebody, perhaps you wouldn't recognise them. But that doesn't really hold water, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. You know, so.
And isn't there a funny incident of your wife?
Well, yeah. Well, what happened, she won't mind me telling you this, because we've discussed this before, but basically she did an alpha course and came back, and we were talking about this very subject. And I said, well, why did nobody recognise him when he first came back? And she suggested that, well, perhaps he'd shaved his beard off.
When I said,
well, it seems unlikely, she did say, well, Robert Powell did. But, of course, I had to explain Robert Powell wasn't the real Jesus. So please don't take offence.
Mrs. Rand.
She's very famous, Mrs. Rand, for that comment.
Just out of interest, did the Alpha Course sort of speak to her in any way?
She really enjoyed it. She was already going to the local church anyway.
Okay. Right.
But it was after she did the Alpha Course, I thought, well, I'm going to have to go and do a course myself. She didn't come back with the right answers for me. But then nobody seems to.
You were getting secondhand stuff.
I was. I've got to go and find out for myself. So that was the reason behind it. So.
You're absolutely right. The different resurrection stories of Jesus appearing to groups of disciples, to the women, they're all kind of unique and different. And in, you know, the road to Emmaus, for some reason, the disciples don't recognize this man until he finally breaks bread. Mary in the garden, so on, doesn't realize it's Jesus. She thinks it's the gardener and whatever. I think what's obvious is that it's Jesus. That's what I think the authors are trying to say. It's Jesus, but he's changed in some way. It's not quite the same Jesus that died. I still think what they're trying to definitely affirm is that this isn't a sort of just a ghostly spiritual apparition. They want us to understand this is physical. This is a Jesus who sits down on the beach and cooks some fish and says, have some of this. But at the same time, it's a Jesus that is obviously at some level different. And for me, I guess my best explanation of that would be what we're being presented with is a glorified, risen Jesus. A Jesus who kind of is almost the example of what all Christians are hoped for in the resurrection, that they will have these, you know, imperishable bodies, as Paul puts it. And I think inevitably that's going to mean that the physical aspects of ourselves, we're going to be somehow different. Maybe there will be a sense in which you won't quite recognize yourself at first. But obviously they did then recognize Jesus. Now, obviously, you could go down a completely different route and say, well, maybe this is all sort of more of a spiritual experience they were having. And
is it necessary to have a physical resurrection?
Well,
or is a spiritual resurrection enough? Is that not what people who are Christians
I meet plenty of Christians who kind of would understand the resurrection in that way.
Yes.
And maybe there was a time when I would have been sort of said, okay, take it or leave it, bodily, spiritual resurrection maybe doesn't make much difference. I've actually come to a point where I'm actually more concerned, actually, that we do understand it as a physical event.
Right.
And that's for a variety of reasons.
Paul's sighting is quite some time after. That can't have been a physical.
Well, obviously, with Paul, you are dealing with some kind of a vision. Obviously,
yes.
The people who are around him when Jesus meets him.
So if Paul's having a vision, why is it not a vision for the rest of the...
Well, I think there's a sense in which Paul obviously comes at a later stage. There has been this, the ascension of Jesus and so on. And so the physical appearances of Jesus, where there's evidently a bodily Jesus standing in front of people, are kind of for that period when he is sort of, that 40-day period between the resurrection and ascension. Nonetheless, I think Paul still definitely affirmed physical resurrection. That's what he understood the resurrection would be. That's what he understood Jesus' resurrection had been. And I think that, I think if you read someone like N.T. Wright on this, he brilliantly explains why it would have been very odd for Jews to have posited some kind of spiritual type of resurrection when the only kind of resurrection they ever talked about was physical resurrection.
But that's because they were expecting a physical resurrection.
Yes, they were expecting a physical resurrection, but it would have been strange for them to posit a different type of resurrection in that context. And I think the language itself that's used in the Greek and so on does affirm the physicality of this, the assumption that you simply can't separate at some level soul and body in the way that we sort of have in our rather dualistic view of things, maybe 2,000 years later in the West. But for me, again, just going back to this, I think another reason why it's important that we understand this as something physical is that I think you actually rob something from the heart of Christianity if you just sort of say, oh, it's just something metaphorical or spiritual or whatever. Because actually, Christianity at its heart is about God coming to redeem and restore a physical creation. It's something that's meant to be understood in flesh and blood terms. Jesus came as a flesh and blood individual because the creation was good and it's been marred, but it's going to be restored. And for me, it's really important then that when God manifests his victory, it's in a physical way. It's not just in a sort of other place, dimension, spiritual way. It's actually something's happened in the physical world, which is a sign of what will happen to the entire physical creation at a spiritual level, at a physical level. It's all going to be made right. It's all going to be put back into order. And for me, that's why, for me, it's so important to understand the resurrection as a physical event. Because otherwise, if you just turn it into this sort of spiritual thing that happened, it kind of says something about, well, Christianity is more concerned with it just sort of a heavenly, spiritual, quote-unquote, sort of ghostly type of existence somewhere.
If you're a Christian who's living your life through Jesus, you can only ever know him in a spiritual way as opposed to a physical
way. I would say yes, in a sense, at this level, we know it. But at the same time, actually, there's a reason why your brothers,
this is the
your
belief
brothers
that in the long term is going to be something.
It's the long term, but there's also the fact is we are put into a physical community of the church called the church. That the Bible says is the body of Christ on earth. It's meant to be understood that the physical stuff matters. We may not have a physical Jesus walking with us like he did with the disciples, but we are, I think, promised that kingdom will be a physical place where there will be a kind of
at the end of time.
It's
about end of time stuff as opposed to living your life on a daily basis.
I mean, obviously, we're not in the position where we have a physical Jesus to sort of walk with us today. But I don't think that takes away from the fact that the resurrection was meant to be understood as a kind of an inbreaking into the not just a kind of spiritual world, but to the physical world where something changes quite radically.
Can I just say that the point four that you bring up on this is the growth of the church, and that's what, for me, that's one of the most compelling things about a very strong piece of evidence, because in my view something drastic must have happened to those disciples. Something really strong must have happened to them to turn them from being people who were running away and frightened to walking out and spreading the word of God, and to such an extent that they gave their lives for it.
Yeah. So, well, we're in agreement in that case, because I think for me that that there's what, you know, a friend of mine, Andy Bannister, termed a resurrection shaped hole at the center of that story. It's, well, you need some kind of an explanation for what got this Christian movement started.
Yeah.
This very countercultural movement as well. This looked quite different to the Judaism around it. It was quite distinctive. Just on a personal level, you know, people needing to live their lives, commercial people, traders, you know, it would have been a massive inconvenience worshipping on a Sunday, which we know they started to do from quite early on, because obviously that was the first day of the week. It was the Monday of the Jewish world, a Sunday. So I think there's a number of different bits of evidence which show something happened, something important enough that they changed the day they worshipped. They became this, you know, group of radical people saying something really unusual about what had happened to their Messiah. And suddenly willing to risk persecution, beatings, death, and all kinds of, you know, restrictions.
Plus the fact it's still going. That's the other thing. We're 2,000 years down the line, and there's still a premier Christian radio station.
There is.
So, I mean, that in itself is
It is interesting. There's been a surprising tenacity to the faith. I think it was probably dodgiest very early on, when it was at its most fragile, in a sense, you know, and could have been stamped out at some point in its first years. But that's another aspect, I think, of Christianity that's interesting. And whether you count this as evidence or not for its truth, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder. But it's got this extraordinary ability to make itself work in very different cultures and contexts, so that I can go to Africa and spend a year in Namibia, as I did in my gap year with my wife after university, and experience Christianity there, but in a way that makes sense for those people in their culture from the Ovambo tribe that we were living with. And at the core of it is something which kind of transcends both our different cultures, which is this person, Jesus Christ. And I've found that Christianity does have this extraordinary ability to connect and work and transform all kinds of different cultures and places, which for me at least is another evidence of that, you know, the fact it works in that way seems to be a sign of its truth. Whereas many other religions that have come and gone or are still with us have tended to be much more localized and sort of kind of for a specific time and place is where that seems to work, but doesn't seem to have the kind of elasticity, the way that Christianity manages to.
I mean, we'll probably talk about the evolution of the church a bit later on, because
if we get time.
If we get time. But the church does seem to, as an outsider looking in, to me, it looks, especially in the UK, where attendances are falling, it probably needs to evolve slightly different way, would you say? I don't really want to get into it, because that's going to go on forever.
We can get into that now. I mean, this, you know, there are all kinds of theories out there about what the church needs to do in order to sort of stem, you know, the decline. In all honesty, I sometimes think the decline story is maybe overplayed a bit. I think we're seeing, in the UK at least, what I think often happens in the church is you sort of get peaks and troughs, and there's a kind of, if you like, very often there's a cycle going on at some level. And I think what we've seen happening in the last few decades is a kind of a nominal Christianity that sprung up. After a genuine kind of period of spiritual revival and so on that took place, maybe going back to Victorian times or something like that, gradually calcifying into the next generation not really owning that spiritual dimension to the faith, it becoming a nominal thing, and then people, you know, give up on that. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I think what that does is means that you get down to the core numbers who are actually this stuff makes sense for, that who are excited and passionate about their faith, and then you maybe start to see things flourish again and grow, and for the Christian church to
certainly. We're going to talk about the atheism part of the book. I mean, you would describe it: church attendance falling in the UK. 12% of the population went to church in 1980, or put themselves down as going. 5%. It's only 5% in 2015. And you say that people describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, which is quite an interesting phrase for me.
Yes,
because I know what they mean. I know what they mean by that.
I feel the same.
I feel like, I mean, there's a Bishop John Shelby Spong, who I know you've had on the show, who describes us as being believers in exile. And I actually know what he means by that phrase, is that we're on the edge of it but can't quite But then that's probably the last chapter of the book, to be honest.
And I think you're very typical, you know, if you don't mind me saying
that's fine, Mike,
of many people who, I think there's a kind of distrust almost of organised religion, because I think we've kind of gone a bit wary of authority figures and people telling you what to believe and so on. But people haven't shaken that feeling that, but I'm not quite prepared to go fully down the Richard Dawkins line of, well, all that actually exists is matter in motion and there's no purpose or meaning or ultimate meaning and purpose in the world.
Yeah.
And people say, no, I'm not going to go that direction either. And they're sort of somewhere in the middle where they people are very kind of interesting, aren't they? Because I think the average person who may never set foot inside a church still probably prays quite often. Do you know what I mean? And stuff like that. And there's very natural instincts within people that is kind of, for me at least, is a symptom of the fact that there's still that sense of God is there. It never quite gets fully extinguished, I think, in many people. And I think that the challenge for the church is to help people realise that actually church is not about ultimately a religion, a set of rules. And this is a bit of a cliche, I know, but it is genuinely about a relationship. It's about a completely new way of living once you discover the thing that is behind everything, you know, the God made known to us in Jesus Christ. And for me, the problem is so many people approach church as being a sort of, it's basically like a club where you have to join it and abide by a certain set of rules, behave a certain way, and it just sounds like another kind of chore on your life. And yeah, I can understand why people wouldn't want that.
In an earlier chapter of the book, you describe as, if you've got a set of keys, there's a key that will open your wife's church, and that's the route to God. But I was a bit perturbed by that actual phrase. That's probably too strong a word, but I was interested by that phrase, because to me that may not be the only key on that key ring that opens that door.
That's an interesting, so just to kind of set the context of this, I was sort of in a chapter saying, okay, if there is a God and we were trying to decide whether he has revealed himself to us through a religion, would we have to exhaustively investigate all the religions to find out, you know, which one was true? And my little analogy was simply, well, I've got a set of keys that let me into my wife's church, as you say, but quite a few of them look quite similar. So sometimes I'll stand at the door and try a couple until I get the right one. But if I get the right one first time, that opens the door. I don't then check that if all the others work as well. I was simply making the point that if you found that the evidence from the off that Jesus Christ is who he said he was and rose from the dead, then you've got pretty good grounds for saying, I think I found the right key, and I don't need to investigate every other option. But now, you're saying, what if other keys also open
the door?
Okay, well, that's an interesting one.
And I think other keys do open the door. See, to my view, there are many ways to God.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily mean you have to go the Jesus Christ route, but Jesus looks to be, it could be, a path to God. And in your case, it certainly is your path to God. Definitely your path to God. But for me, one of the big problems with the Christian church has always been that you have to come our way or no way. We are the one true way.
Our way or the highway.
Yeah. All because of probably a phrase in John that says, I am the truth, the way, the life. The way, truth, the life, the way. Sorry if I got that wrong. But
but you're absolutely right. I mean, what you're expressing, I think, is, again, a very common view. There's a kind of a sense that pluralism, you know, that it's a bit arrogant almost for one religion to claim it has the truth and it has the way.
Well, I think it's more of a recruitment drive.
Okay.
That's the way I look at it. Okay, if you don't come with us, you won't go to heaven.
Okay. Well, I think it has been done, you know, put that way in the past. It's not necessarily the way I would put things across to someone. But I do have a fundamental problem with pluralism, with the idea that there are many paths to God and, you know, we're all just different expressions of the same thing or whatever. Which is, firstly, if you actually look at most religions, they that's not what they're saying. That most of them are making some kind of an exclusive claim about the way we get to God, the way we encounter God.
Well, I would think they were wrong as well.
Right, but then you're then making an exclusive claim. You see, you're doing exactly the same thing as the other religions are doing by saying, ah, they've all got it wrong, I've got it right.
No, I'm not saying that. I think, I don't know if I've got anything right.
Okay.
I don't come from a position saying that I think this, but from an outsider looking in, I think that there must be more than one path Pathway to God. I mean, but that, let's be honest, I think I found God through Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right, fair enough.
Which is not a religion at all.
I think you found something.
Yes.
And I think, you know, in my view, Mike, what you found is something that has opened up the God question for you in a big way. And that's wonderful. That's to be celebrated. And when I critique other religions, I'm not by saying that sort of saying, and they've got everything wrong. I think there's a lot that other religions get right. In a sense, it's the atheists, more often than not, who are claiming all of the stuff that the religions are saying is wrong. I think there's actually stuff I can agree with my Muslim friend about, you know, certain aspects of the way the world is and so on. But we do, at the end of the day, religions are making different claims about God, and they can't all be right at the same time. So if the Muslim says, you know, you have to believe that Allah is God's messenger and, you know, believing in him is the route to heaven, well, that's a very different claim to the Christian one or the Hindu one or the Jewish one. Or so just logically, they can't all be right at the same time. So, but what that means is that you're then saying, Mike, well, I know better. sorry, I'm not saying you know better,
no,
but I'm
no,
saying
no, no.
The way it could be seen is you saying, they're all wrong. They've all just got, you know, whatever analogy you want to use, they're all feeling different parts of the elephant or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing the bigger picture. And guys, look, it's all going to be fine. You'll all get there in the end.
Well, I suppose what I'm saying is that I don't see anything wrong with there being more than one pathway to God.
Okay, well, that's fine.
That's all I'm saying.
But
now, whether the minutiae of each religion or the basic core beliefs of each religion are right or wrong, I don't know.
Right.
But if you've got somebody who's a God-fearing member of the Jewish community, it can't be that he's not gone the right path, or he or she had not gone the right path.
Well, look, that's a fair question and a comment, but I think that's a little bit different to what you've been saying, because what you're saying there is it doesn't seem fair that people who genuinely follow, you know, what they that to their best of their knowledge, the religious path they've chosen, doesn't get fair that they would be excluded from the kingdom in some way. Now, that may be true. That doesn't mean Christianity isn't the correct way, though. It doesn't exclude that possibility. It just means that we're maybe not in a position to judge who in that final day God says yes to. I think it's still perfectly compatible, though, with the view that Jesus is the way, the truth and the life. And for me, I'm not here to say that God-fearing Jew who, you know, has done everything within his power to follow and love and obey God within his context will be denied entry because he didn't believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. I will leave that to God, because God knows that person's heart and is a far fairer judge of people than I could ever be. So I'm not going to sort of stand in judgment over someone as to when God meets them on that final day. All I know is that I have encountered and find that there's objective evidence for this person, Jesus, who said he was the way, the truth, and the life. Now, when I read those words, I don't necessarily read them as saying, and therefore, if you didn't say my words in this particular prayer in the 30 years you had on earth, whatever it was, then you're not getting in, buddy.
No.
I'm open to the idea, sort of in the way that C.S. Lewis had, that maybe there will be a way in which God sort of will reveal to people that whatever they were looking for, it was Jesus they were looking for in that final day. Who knows?
That's
speculation.
Good. No, that's good.
But all I'm trying to say is I think it's perfectly compatible to say Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through him. But that God, in his mercy and grace, may be able to show people that it was Jesus that they've been searching for all the time, and will grant that ultimate desire that person had in that sense. That may actually make me a little bit more liberal than a lot of my Christian friends who are more exclusivist than that, and would say, no, it really has to be something that's decided on in this life, and you only
you
get
can
that
see
chance.
You can see where I come from, though. This is a big stumbling block for me, because if I look at humanity as being all in God's image, as you've described in the previous podcast that we did, or the previous recording that we did, if we are all designed in God's image, then there must be a space for God in every human being, no matter what religious background
of course,
they come from.
Yeah, so. I mean, and I would completely agree with that. I think that we all have that image. We're all image bearers. And being a Christian doesn't somehow suddenly turn you into the image of God. We're all created in the image of God. Mm. But I believe that there are certain expressions of religion which don't bring out that image-bearing quality of us in that sense. I think it's like we find our true selves, for me at least, when we follow Christ, when we trust in him. There's something about that that sort of gets to the heart of why God created us, who he created us to be, that I don't see in other religions. I see a lot of religions which give you a set of rules that you follow in order to sort of meet the requirements of that religion and of God. In Christianity, I find something very different, which is something which transforms and sets free and says, I'm going to write a law on your heart, not on tablets of stone, and it's going to transform you as an individual. And all I can say is, for me, that if I'm going to encourage people to choose a path, it's going to be that one. I can't apologise for that.
No, don't apologise. Yeah. No, well, yeah. You wouldn't, would you? No.
Can I time is already running away, Mike.
Okay.
This is going way too fast, isn't it?
It is.
And we've got so much more to talk about. But we've covered quite a lot of ground already. But we've already arrived at the end of the second segment of our conversation today on Unbelievable. It's me being grilled. Normally I'm the one asking the questions, but today Mike Rand, former police officer and Agnostic Show listener, is here to ask further questions about Unbelievable, the book. It's the book I've written explaining why, after 10 years of hosting all these conversations with atheists, skeptics and people of other faiths as well, I'm still a Christian. You can read it for yourself and indeed download for free the first chapter at unbelievablebook.co.uk. We've even got some special signed copies you can now purchase from our website. So that's a bit exciting. If you really want a signed copy, you can go there for that. unbelievablebook.co.uk. Mike, shall we try and keep going in the next section?
Let's go for it.
We'll see how much we can get through. Do join us again in just a moment's time.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Doing things a bit differently, actually, though, when it comes to that on next week's programme. We're going to be talking about out-of-body experiences, and in fact, neither of my guests are going to be Christians next week. Sue Blackmore is an atheist, and she's going to be explaining why she lost faith in the whole idea of near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, has come to see it's purely a phenomenon of the brain. She's got a new book out on the science of out-of-body experiences. And Graham Nichols joins me as well. Now, again, not a Christian, but someone who does believe in the reality of out-of-body experiences, says he's experienced them himself. So it's going to be quite an interesting discussion on an area that I think lots of people are interested in these days. If you'd like to come back for that, that's our subject on next week's programme. Straight after today's show, though, Stanley Hauervas is Katie Stock's guest on The Profile. That's a must listen for anyone who's into theology. He has been named by Time as the America's best theologian. It's a label he isn't very keen on wearing himself. And he's got a lot to say about US church and state out there. And if you want to listen back to that programme, it's available via the Profile podcast as well. And also available to read in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, our September edition. You can ask for a free sample copy of that, by the way, at the website premierchristianity.com/free sample. I'm the senior editor. I can vouch for it. It's an excellent title. Got a bit more of your feedback coming up at the end of today's programme right now, though. Time to continue my discussion with Mike.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's been great fun again, and the time again has flown chatting to Mike Rand about the new book, a special edition of the programme, part two, really, of the conversation I started with Mike a couple of months ago in the first edition of this programme, where he's come in and he's asked questions about my faith, about my take on Christianity in relation to the book I've written on that subject, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists I'm Still a Christian. The book is called Unbelievable. It's available from unbelievablebook.co.uk. Mike's been a wonderful, gracious and interesting interviewee, and I've really enjoyed spending the time with you. There's lots of areas that we've, again, as we did last time, run out of time to talk about. So we're going to, I think, skip the chapter on suffering and evil the book, though obviously readers can look at it for themselves.
I mean, to be honest with you, there have been so many shows that you've done in relation to suffering.
True.
And to fit suffering into an hour is a real problem.
Exactly, so, exactly. Fitting into a chapter was very hard as well. But the chapter 8 of the book, I titled My 10 Minutes with Richard Dawkins. And that's actually, I found, in terms of feedback, the chapter people sometimes flick to first.
Okay.
Because it looks interesting. And they give me their feedback on that before they read the rest of the book. But
I mean, Richard Dawkins is known as perhaps one of the more aggressive atheists. And certainly a few years ago was leading quite a big campaign against Christianity.
And I believe he's coming. There's some sort of an event, a theatre event, going on in October here in London. He's going to be on stage with Sam Harris, who's another of the horsemen of the new atheism, and Matt Dillahunty, who's a well-known atheist out in the States as well. Some sort of celebration of reason and science.
Have you ever invited Sam Harris? When he was alive, Christopher Hitchens. I actually think Christopher Hitchens is brilliant.
Wouldn't it have been great to have Christopher Hitchens on?
To watch and listen to.
It's one of my big regrets, actually, is that I was given the number of his New York apartment, Christopher Hitchens, because that's where he lived. And I just never rang it. And
Really?
I was waiting for the reason to ring it and say, you've just published this article or you've just done this and I'd like to have you on. And that reason never quite transpired.
Yes.
And so then of course he developed tragically.
He died.
Throat cancer. And then it wasn't, you know, I knew that his time would be precious and I wasn't going to contact him then, and so the opportunity sort of slipped away, but I should have just rung anyway and just said even if he didn't have any interest in coming on, at least I would have spoken to
you'd have known one way or the other, because Peter Hitchens' brother, who comes from a different side, is a Christian,
absolutely
has been on your show at least once
several
or twice.
Times actually and he's obviously
he's very eloquent himself and
they're two sides of the same coin in a way, just hugely different in terms of their faith commitments. But yes, Peter has often spoken about Christopher's own atheism and so on the show as well. But yes, that was if there was anyone who the one that got away, it would definitely be Christopher Hitchens in terms of well-known atheists on the show. I have had, of course, Dawkins on the show. Sam Harris, I haven't managed to have on yet. I have asked several times over the years, and it just hasn't.
Oh, it'd be great if you could get him.
He's
very good
as well.
Who
knows? If you're listening, Sam, or friend of Sam, you're going to be over in London anyway soon. You might as well come in the studio while you've got a spare hour.
Yeah.
And we'll have an interesting conversation. But, I mean, going back to Dawkins, I mean, yes, in many ways he has been the archetypal figure of the new atheism. And in many ways this show has, really from its inception, he's been a regular name on the show, because the show sort of started just before, really, he published The God Delusion, and that kind of set the tone for the debate for a long time.
Do I get that? Is this just an impression I've got, that perhaps they're not quite so vociferous as they used to be, or is it?
In terms of, I mean, it depends who you bump into. I think generally the steam has run a little bit low now on the new atheist movement. Right. I think a lot of people tend to distinguish themselves apart from that movement rather than by it. Many of the atheists I meet, nonetheless, there are still, you know, he still has a huge following, Dawkins, especially out in the USA, you know, where he can fill auditoriums at the drop of a hat, I think. Even though he sometimes gets disinvited from them as well, but that's another story. But with Dawkins, you know, I personally, for me he's been a wonderful thing on the show, because he's produced so much interesting conversation and material, you know, to debate. And actually, when I had him properly on the show, when he came on by phone to debate the Old Testament, he was actually quite mellow and congenial.
So
it depends, I think, on the mood you catch him in.
You actually managed to meet him in Oxford.
I did.
Where he was doing some lecture or whatever. And you got a 10 minutes recorded interview out of him.
Yeah, so this was the first time I managed to meet him. And I just thought this would be an interesting story to include in the book. And in fact, it then has been often the first thing people remark upon when they read the book. But the show had been going a few years. I'd reached out for Dawkins, but hadn't managed to land him, as it were, as a guest on the show. And then it was announced he was going to be debating, having a public debate with John Lennox, well-known Christian thinker, in Oxford, part of a series of debates they were having, actually, both here and in the US. Wonderful setting, the Natural History Museum in Oxford. So they had these sort of big dinosaur skeletons behind them as they debated. I really enjoyed the debate. There was a sort of a bit of a press thing afterwards where I got to ask questions along with other journalists of both of them at the front. And then I had an invitation to the sort of post debate reception happening at a nearby college. And so I left the building to make my way there, and lo and behold, who should be pushing his bicycle next to me but Dawkins himself. So I took the opportunity to say
a bit
hello.
Nervous for you,
wasn't it? I was. Because it's one of those moments where you're thinking, oh, this is my opportunity. Yeah, do I take
it
now?
It.
You know. Well, in the event, we just had a little chat as he pushed his bicycle along, and I sort of introduced myself and said, "I'd love to get a little time with you once we're in the reception." So he said, oh, "Okay, yes, that's fine." And so that did happen. Once the reception was underway, a lot of hubbub in the room, and you'll hear this if you go back to the recording on that particular show. But I did manage to get sort of a 10-minute conversation with him, in which we just sort of had our own mini debate, really, on the back of the discussion he'd had with John Lennox. One of the significant elements of that, and a little bit of our conversation that actually got shared around quite a lot at the time on blogs and social media and so on, was where we sort of talked about morality in particular. And I sort of tried to challenge him on whether his beliefs in certain moral things, like rape is wrong, for instance, could be justified on a purely evolutionary view, an unguided process, let's say. Because I'm not saying, Christians, obviously, there are plenty of Christians who believe in evolution. It's just they believe that there's a sort of a purposiveness behind it, and that we don't just get our morality, whatever gets, chucked out the other end. There's a sort of a God who is behind the whole thing. But I sort of challenged him on whether he could really say that rape is wrong if that's just what he happens to believe at this point in his evolutionary history, and nature could have delivered something else entirely. I mean, it does deliver other things in the animal kingdom. You do get rape in the animal kingdom as a way of passing on your genes and so on. But we don't feel like that is the way we should act. It feels like wrong, doesn't it? And just to cut a long story short, the conversation finished with me saying, but as it stands, in an your value judgment that rape is wrong is just as random, in a sense, as any product of evolution. And he said, you could say that. In any case, nothing about it makes it more probable that there is anything supernatural. And I said, okay, but ultimately, your belief that rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact that we've evolved five fingers rather than six. And he said, you could say that, yeah. And then the conversation sort of moved on. So I just find that an interesting admission, because I think that's a very honest admission, that essentially saying, actually, yeah, my moral beliefs are sort of just handed down to me by my evolutionary history. There's not really a sort of objective facts or about how we should treat each other, the way we should be to each other. It's just the way it is, just what we happen to have been delivered at this point.
Oh, well, we discussed it at some length in the previous show.
So I for me, that's, that ties in what for me, that we've discussed before is one of, for me, the strongest arguments for God, which is this moral argument. That idea that that there's no oughtness, there's no, there's no kind of real moral realm out there. That just doesn't jive with my experience at all. I see a world in which there is right and wrong, where rape really is wrong, whether or not evolution had sort of bred it into us in some way. It would still be wrong, even if, in cultures where it is practiced and accepted or has been in the past or whatever it might be, it's still wrong. And for me, you can't, or at least I find it extremely difficult to see how you make sense of that moral sense of the objectiveness of these things on an atheistic framework.
I mean, we did go into some depth.
So we won't tread that ground again.
So, but I know you had Richard Dawkins on once with there was a, I think it was a recording. It wasn't in the studio, that's for sure, with the Archbishop of Canterbury, the former Archbishop.
Oh, now
that
you
was a great
it, yes,
show. I've listened to that
a
few times.
Point.
Actually,
well, I guess I hadn't sort of included that appearance.
That was a really good show.
It wasn't specifically an Unbelievable show. I'd been given permission
to use a
discussion he had with Rowan Williams.
Rowan Williams, that's right.
Who was the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time. That was a discussion they had in Oxford. And yes, it was a really interesting
what discussion. What I liked about that discussion was that Richard Dawkins behaved differently, because he obviously, in some respects, I think he looks upon the Archbishop of Canterbury as an equal.
Yes, and he has had this rule about debating. You know, he'll only debate a Pope, an Archbishop, or a.
That's right. And there was a mutual respect between them, which was very good.
Right. So, it was. I'm glad you reminded me of that, actually, because I've often only thought of Dawkins having been on the show twice. But yes, if you were to include me airing someone else's discussion of it, that's true.
I don't know if we've got time. I was just going to have a quick chat about chapter 9, which was choosing to live in the Christian story.
We've got 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do what we can.
One of the things that you often ask atheist guests is, what evidence can we give you that would convince you to believe in God? And that question was actually asked to me when I came on the show with David Robertson. And it's a very difficult one to answer, especially when you're put on the spot. You think, I don't know, really. But I'm in a similar position with yourself, because I know what your background is and I know how deeply involved you are with Christianity. I mean, of all the arguments you've heard over the years, is there something that would make you not believe?
Make
me
not believe.
I mean, you would have a lot to lose.
Yeah,
you'd have a lot more than
absolutely.
Mike Rand would for believing, because you'd lose, if you like, your career, what you do.
I mean... they might still employ me as the atheist presenter of Unbelievable.
I think not.
You never know.
I might get a job on BBC Radio 2.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think you have to own up to your biases. You know, it's obviously, to some extent, in my interest for Christianity to be true. I still hope, even though that's true, and it's true obviously in the other direction, I think for a lot of atheists will own up to the fact that I've got reasons, other than intellectual reasons, why I'd rather it not be true. You know,
yes.
So we're all coming to this with a certain amount of assumptions and biases. But I hope that in doing Unbelievable, that it's a sign that I'm open to hearing other perspectives. I'm open to having my mind changed, and I hope that if I found that argument, which just was too compelling for me to
suddenly tipped you over the edge,
tipped me over the edge.
This isn't true.
Then I would have the courage of my convictions to follow say no. I've got to. Now again, it's very difficult for me to say what that argument would be, because I haven't met that argument yet.
No,
it's possible there is one out there.
Well, I can't. For 10 years worth of shows, I can't believe that you haven't heard any, more or less heard it all. Actually,
and in a sense. I've definitely heard arguments which are more compelling and produce more doubts, if you like, than others. Yeah. There are, of course, arguments which have a more of a potency to them when it comes to their criticisms of faith. I guess as much as I've encountered those, and some of them have given me sleepless nights and I've had to think long and hard about them, I've come around to seeing that actually, as much as there's always a flip side to every argument, you know, and probably, you know, we don't have time to discuss it really, but that suffering and evil has always struck me as the hardest one, you know, inevitably, because I struggle with when awful things happen to people that just don't deserve. It causes me to question things, but there's also a sense in which it's when you weigh that against the other option of, well, okay, maybe there's no God. It doesn't really present you with, for me at least, a good alternative. It's like, well, that just makes suffering meaningless. In my view, in the Christian worldview, it's certainly a mystery. And I think there are helpful ways to think about it. And I think there are potentially reasons why God would allow a measure of suffering and evil into a person's life. But it's still a mystery. And I'm not here to say, you know, in any individual case of suffering, why God has allowed this. You know, I'm simply not in that position to judge those sorts of things. But on atheism, I just find it turns everything, when there is no rhyme or reason to any of it, it just turns it into meaninglessness. And on an existential level, I would still rather live in the world where I don't have my questions answered, but I have a hope of a God who will one day bring it all together than in a world where there just really isn't any kind of a story bringing it together.
Well, I think to me, what strikes me is that, and I really love your book and I love reading it and everything else, and I've read it two or three times now, obviously, because I was coming back on the show, so I've reread it, and I've picked up other things from rereading it a second time, actually, which is quite interesting. But it all stems back to evidence alone, or lack of evidence alone, whichever way you look at it, isn't enough, really, to believe in the Christian faith or to believe in any faith.
Yeah, it's,
there has to be some sort of experience, doesn't there?
No,
there has
I
to be some sort
agree.
Of experience with
I completely
it.
Agree. And different apologists take different views on this, but I have come to the view that no one gets converted on the basis of an intellectual argument
Absolutely.
Alone.
Yeah.
That's just not what happens.
Okay.
Because ultimately, God's in the process somewhere as well. It's if it was just about, you know, creating a good intellectual argument, then it's almost as though God's somewhat unnecessary in the whole process, you know, if it's something we can purely do by the intellect alone. But for me, there's always other stuff going on whenever someone does find faith.
Yes.
And apologetics, the main advantage I find is what it can do for someone is help to remove some intellectual barriers on the journey, if you like. But someone still has to want to walk down that road for what's on offer at the end of it. And no one's going to force you to. If you don't really want God, there's always going to be another objection you can reach for. No, you're never going to be compelled by the evidence to believe in God in that sense.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think that makes sense, because otherwise it would feel a bit like you are being forced to believe something rather than choosing to believe something or to trust in something.
It goes back to the free will, which is part of last time's discussion.
I think there might be good reasons why God doesn't give us absolutely overwhelming proof of his existence.
The hidden God, we talked about that with David Robson as well.
Exactly. And so that's, I cover all of that in the final chapter. But I guess the main point of it is that apologetics is not the end game, if you like. And I think, unfortunately, you know, people who do love apologetics and get a bit obsessed by it, maybe, often think this is it, this is the thing that we need, this is the things that are going to revolutionize people's lives, and actually it can end up turning into a bit of an idol, actually, where it's kind of turns into an intellectual game where, you know, as long as I win the argument, then God exists, sort of thing. And God exists regardless for me of whether we made a good argument or not. And most people who end up believing in God, trusting in God, are not doing so simply on the basis of an intellectual argument. Something has happened that has met their heart as well as their head. Certainly that's true in my case, and in the case of everyone else I can think of who was converted.
Yes. Yeah.
We're nearly out of time.
Okay. Well, it's been brilliant.
It's been such fun. Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you very much for the invite, and thanks very much for, you know, the last two or three times that I've been up here. It's been a great experience.
It's been really nice getting to know you.
Yeah, it's been
Mike.
Very good. Thank you.
And I look forward to, you know, hearing from you in the future.
Yeah, I'll keep in touch.
We'll
keep in
touch. Continuing listener.
Yes, indeed.
Who knows, mate?
Every time I do the washing up, the headphones go on.
you and I are the same. That's where I listen to my podcast. Either if I'm driving somewhere or doing the washing up or some other
meeting. Yeah, just out of the garden. So it's great, actually. It's great, yeah.
And can I just say, Mike, thank you for your openness to investigating this stuff, because that's not always the attitude you find among people for whom, you know, they're not convinced. But I just find I feel like you're genuinely seeking and want to.
Yeah, I mean, I've always come here on the understanding that, you know, I've got no background in theology or anything. I'm just trying to find the answers, really.
You're an ordinary Joe.
I am indeed. I am indeed, yeah.
Mike, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
And agreeing to grill me again. You can find out more about the book, of course, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Free downloadable first chapter there. And options now to purchase a signed copy via our website. So unbelievablebook.co.uk. Audiobook also in the works for those who prefer listening to reading stuff on a page, so we'll keep you up to date about how you can get hold of that in due course, but again, thank you, Mike, for being with me today. And thank you for listening to today's program.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to hearing what you made of my discussion with Mike today. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You're welcome to disagree with me, by the way. Give me a harder time than Mike, if you like. You can also do that, of course, on our social media at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page for the group. Just a quick mention before we go into some other people who have been reviewing the Unbelievable book of Abdo, who got in touch to say, thank you for putting on an incredibly productive and civil show. I find the show quite refreshing and a testament to how positive discourse can be had. I'm currently running a series of studies in the field of social psychology on how people perceive those who alter their religious views. Thus far, I've focused on Christians and non-believers, with results showing that people tend to think that those who leave their own group do so not because they've carefully considered arguments leading them to this new conclusion, but instead for more superfluous, non-conscious reasons, e.g. because he became a Christian because he wanted comfort from death, or he became an atheist to indulge in sin. I'm looking to run a study looking at more high-profile conversions to see if the effect carries on in a more real-world setting. I gave people made-up vignettes before. Do you know any other examples I could use of these real-world conversions? Well, if you've got a suggestion for real-world conversions, one way or the other, for Abdo and her research, why not get in touch with her? She's happy for you to email her. Abdo.elnakouri, that's E-L-N-A-K-O-U-R-I, at uwaterloo.ca. Okay? Abdo.elnakouri at uwaterloo.ca. Thank you for writing in, Abdo, and I'd be very interested to see what your research yields in the end. Great to see some lovely reviews coming through on Amazon as well from various people, not just Christians, but non-Christians as well, who've been reading the Unbelievable book. Dave said, as an agnostic, I've really enjoyed Justin's podcast series Unbelievable and was keen to see the book release. It's well written and easygoing. I enjoyed reading it and it did give me a bit more food for thought. I'm still not quite converted, but will continue my quest and see where it takes me. For anyone with even a passing interest in Christianity, I'd certainly recommend this book as a good starting point. As in his podcast, Justin comes across as a nice bloke, someone you'd love to have a good long chat in the pub to. Thank you very much, Dave. That was Dave's leaving a review on Amazon. Another one came in from someone who said, I'm a non-Christian who thoroughly enjoyed reading this book. It succeeds in being educational and thought-provoking without being heavy work. Therefore, this is a book that will serve beginners for the subject, as well as those who are already familiar with some of the themes that Justin explores. It's a superb bonus that you can go on to explore the podcast archive of the Unbelievable radio show at no expense and go deeper into the subjects that Justin writes about. Public life, now dominated by rolling news, political squabbles and celebrity spotting, and Justin's book politely sweeps aside these frivolities and gets serious in a dignified and respectful manner. It's clear that 10 years of moderating a variety of religious and scientific debates has sharpened Justin's thoughts. His arguments are cogent and often rest on sound empirical grounds. Justin's primary aim is to make the case for Christianity, and I believe he's done a great job for that. I'm not a Christian myself, and surely never will be, but I still very much appreciate the value of this book on an educational and spiritual level. Thank you very much for that. And hey, who knows? Who knows where the path could lead? You're not a Christian yet, but maybe you could be one day. In any case, thank you for tuning in to today's show. And again, the book's available now if you want to get hold of it, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Signed copies available from the website now if you buy it from the Premier website, and of course the audiobook as well. So lots of reasons to go and check it out. Thanks for being with me today. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. You're unbelievable. Susan Blackmore and Graham Nichols are going to be debating out-of-body and near-death experiences. Sue Blackmore's new book, Seeing Myself, the new science of out-of-body experiences, is dealing with that and her perspective on this. She's an atheist when it comes to this. She believes it's all in the brain. Not so, says Graham. There's more to it than that. And we'll be hearing why on next week's show. Hope you can come back for another interesting conversation. See you then.
Lowe sabe que ahora más que nunca buscas el precio más bajo. Por eso, cuenta con nuestra garantía de precios bajos para obtener lo que necesitas a precios competitivos para tus proyectos. Y si encuentras un artículo igual a un precio más bajo que califica, te lo igualaremos. Lowe's. Nosotros ayudamos. Tú ahorras. Igualación de precio aplica al artículo igual con un precio actual en tiendas calificadas. Aplican términos y exclusiones. Detalles en Lowe's.com/garantía precios bajos.